Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Thank you for joining us on this little podcast that we're going to do today. I'm really excited about this podcast. It is a topic that I have wanted to discuss for a long time. And then somebody wrote a book that seemed to nail exactly what I wanted to read about. That somebody is Mike Cole. Before I introduce him, though, I'm going to introduce a frequent House of Pod contributor and bud. We have Mr. Will Poole, otherwise known as Christy Yamaguchi Main on the internet. Will, thank you for joining me again, buddy.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. And calling me a contributor is very gracious. I don't know that I contribute much other than dipshittery, but I'm glad to do it when I can. So thank you.
It's world-class dipshittery, my friend. I am so happy you're back. I really enjoy only hearing you, but seeing your majestic and beautiful flowing beard.
I feel like I put some work into this appearance. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I made you work for it. You had to read a book.
Yeah, exactly.
You read a book.
I enjoy reading, but God damn, I am a slow reader. Holy cow. I am, it's about the effort. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I absorbed a lot. So I mean, I'm stoked.
And it is an amazing book. It is not, I wouldn't say it's a light read. It is the author himself in the book says it isn't doing exhaustive coverage of the topic, but it feels like he covered a lot in it. It is The Bronze Lie, Shattering the Myth of Spartan Warrior Supremacy by Mike Cole. Mike, I'm going to give you a little introduction here. You tell me if this is incorrect. Mike has worked for the CIA. He's worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Office of Naval Intelligence, the New York Coast Guard, or Coast Guard at least. I'm not sure exactly where he's located there. And his writing has been in the New York Times, the Daily Beast, and this book is epic. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Mike, we're going to get into this book. We have a lot to talk about with this book. But before we do that, there's been something that's been weighing on my mind for a while. Now, Will, you probably don't even remember this. You probably just posted this and didn't even think twice about it. But you posted something.
I am legitimately terrified as to what the hell you're about to bring up.
I think you just retweeted this. It was someone had posed this real and difficult sort of mind-bending question, which was, say you had a girlfriend and you had a mom and they switched bodies. Their minds went to the other bodies. And there was only one way to switch them back. And that was you had to have sex with one of them. which one would you pick? And I know you didn't think twice about this, man, but it haunted me.
It's I
have an answer though.
Okay. All right.
But go on. So do you remember this at all? Let me ask you.
I do now. I absolutely remember it. And I think I did just retweet this. This was not an original on my part. I probably just saw it, read it, was horrified, and then immediately smashed the retweet button because other people had to suffer along with me. Sounds like you did as well.
You really fucked me up with this one. Mike, I'm not going to put you on the spot, Mike. You're a real author. You're a real historian. You're a man of letters. I do not want to make you go through this.
What would the Spartans choose in this situation? Maybe you could replace it with their dad and whoever they're mentoring.
As I said, they probably choose very good, excellent. Yeah, they probably choose, depending on their age, they probably choose a young boy or an older man who could teach them.
Right.
But like the Oracle is like, but that's not going to solve the problem. They're like, but we want to do it anyways. That's what we're doing.
We don't really give a shit about the problem. That's besides the point.
Oh my god.
Okay.
All right. So what's your answer then, Kaveh?
Okay. So I thought about this. There's only one way to do it. And it requires the consent. You have to get the consent of both parties in this.
Excellent. Excellent.
But what you do is you say, okay, you get the girlfriend with your mom's brain in there. Uh-huh. And you say, we are going to deeply sedate you, put you under propofol. We're going to have an anesthesiologist there to shut them down completely. They are completely asleep. In a safe manner, in a medical way, they are not there. They are not in there at that point. It's just the body. Now, Ken, that's really creepy, but I'm assuming your girlfriend wants this because she wants her body back.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this is like a body horror situation. Yeah, you were trying to remedy this thing.
Right. So with their consent to do that, that is the only way to get them back that I can think of.
Yeah.
Did I solve it?
I would say that's about... I'm uncomfortable positing any other solutions besides honest with you.
Will, you just smashed the retweet button. The only way to know if we solve this accurately is to track down the original poster get their take on his answer.
God damn it. Okay, I got to figure out. I'll do the research on this and figure out who posited the question originally.
All right, now on to the real topic. I mean, we could talk about that for a lot longer, but it's probably a good idea to move on to the real topic of the episode, which is this book that I am super excited to talk about. So it's this book, The Bronze Lie. The point of it is to sort of look at this, what I would say is a myth, but maybe not. We'll talk about it, of Spartan warrior supremacy and what's called the Spartan Mirage. So let me first start by asking you, this is a term I think that, I don't know if you came up with this term. It sounds like it was in use before you. What is the Spartan Mirage?
Yeah, the Spartan Mirage is not my term. It's a French historian's term that dates way back. The Bronze Lie is my term, and they both refer to the same thing. And it's this sort of popular myth that the Spartans, I mean, this myth is so well taken in modern culture that the word Spartan in English means, you know, a room that isn't well decorated, you know, the person that doesn't own very much. You know, but the word Spartan has become a watchword. You look at sports teams, you look at military units. You know, I was eating dinner tonight, and the refrigerator behind the bar had a big label Spartan, which shows a muscular, you know, guy in a helmet. So this idea of that you're a great warrior, you don't like money, you don't drink alcohol, you don't need comforts, you prize the community over yourself, you're a man of few words.
It sounded like originally you were just describing like a college bachelor, like a not well decorated apartment. You know, doesn't really value money because they don't have much of it. There's not a lot in the fridge.
Right, you're just broke. Yes, exactly. But yeah, that is what the Spartan Mirage is. And of course, it's a mirage because it prevents you from seeing the truth. And I took it a step further, and I'm saying it's not a mirage, man. It's a straight up lie. And this idea, and the perfect example of this, look, this idea really went into overdrive when Frank Miller put out his comic, I think in 98, 300. And then Zack Snyder in 2006 made it into the movie 300, which was a smash hit. And those two pop culture events took this myth and threw it into overdrive to the point where it's insane. it's insane. And so this is was really my motivator to write the book, because, you know, one of the core tenets of the Bronze Lie is this idea that the Spartans never lost, never surrendered, never ran from a fight. And the only way you could believe that is if you don't read any of the contemporary sources. If you ignore Herodotus, if you ignore Thucydides, if you ignore Xenophon, like the people actually writing about this, it's the only way you could believe that. So calling it a mirage is not going far enough. It's a lie. It's just not true. It's not who they were.
You know, we're going to talk about 300, because that to me is like, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about 300 and tied in with a lot of emotions about the 300 movie. So it's probably good that you guys are both here to like actually be the sensible ones.
We'll help you. Sort of, we'll help you.
To help me unfold and as podcasters like to say, unpack. We have a lot to unpack in that.
We're going to hold space. You
Kaveh got self-conscious when he realized he wasn't as like hairless and sexy as Xerxes in that movie.
Yeah, bullshit, man.
Dude, that bullshit. Movie, and Xerxes is a great example. Like back in the days when I still used Twitter, which I highly recommend people don't do because it's cesspool. But back in the day, I refuse to call it X. But back in the day when I used to use Twitter, I tweeted a picture because there are engravings and inscriptions that I think Persepolis and Susa would show Xerxes what he looked like. Right. What do you really look like?
Yeah.
And I put this up next to the picture of like the actor and the way he was presented in the film 300. And I'm like, they're not even trying. Like, guy looks like he's from Mars. Like, it's nothing to do with it.
We might as well just get into the movie, because that is a big part of this. Yeah. So 300, for the people who haven't seen it, it's basically just like you said, Zack Snyder did a movie based pretty closely, I think, on the comic written by Frank Miller. Frank Miller wrote some good stuff. He did some Daredevil runs for the comics. He wrote Sin City, a lot of weird misogynistic stuff in a lot of his things. But this one kind of was like a different take. He like tried to, I think maybe the movie, you mentioned this in your book, actually, there was a movie in the 60s or something about the Spartans who inspired him. And he really kind of wanted to build up that mythos a little bit. In it, the basic premise is there's these 300 brave, very white men, masters of sword fighting and clearly electrolysis, because they have like no hair on their bodies. They fight off this scary brown, effeminate invaders.
Invading hordes.
Invading hordes. Yeah. And what really, okay, so a lot of things bother me, but the thing that bothered me the most was I remember being young and seeing the poster for it. And I remember the tagline was, I'm not lying, a line in the sand for democracy, which is exactly the same line that George Bush used during the Iraq invasion.
And yeah, then they were, oh, that's amazing.
They were grilling Zack Snyder about this. And they were like, don't you think this is kind of a weird time to be doing this, given kind of the situation we're in? And he was like, no, this is 100% historical fact. That's what he said. I'm not making that up. This is historical fact.
Oh, my God.
And so the first thing I want to bring up is this concept of democracy, Sparta as a democracy. Your book goes into a lot of detail about the actual system of it. Can you answer? I know this is a complicated answer that you took a long time to write in this book.
I won't do that to your listeners. Yeah. Don't worry.
I'm going to ask you to if you can drill it down, was Sparta a democracy?
No, not even a little bit. Done. There's your answer.
Okay, next question.
So here's the thing, just a little background on the book. When I wrote The Bronze Lie, I was definitely in the grip, the frenetic grip of the rise of progressivism as a horrific response to Trump's election, right? I view Trump as an existential threat. I was just horrified, and I was really caught up in that. And so I wrote this book because, look, the far right, not just in the United States, but around the world, uses the ancient Spartans as symbols. And I wrote this book to take that away from them and to be like, no, you know, that's bullshit. And in fact, you know, 300, I think it was the National Review that called it, which is a big right wing. Well, it's one of the better right wing magazines, but it's still right wing, said it was one of the best 25 films of all time. You know, it really got a lot of right wing praise.
The guy who's only seen 300, this is really giving me 300 vibes. Like, God, what a short like list of to put. I don't know. That boggles my mind. 25 best movies of all time is insane.
Yeah. Well, so and there's like like, you know, videos. I think you've probably seen it. There was a really famous video where the scene where Liana Doss in the movie kicks the Persian messenger down the well. They put Trump's head on him and he was kicking George Soros down the well. That video was viewed 5 million times. Like, it was just insane. So I really wrote it for that end. But then a really terrible thing happened, which was that a lot of people in my own tribe, because look, this existential horror of Trump really in the American left and in the global left created this like reaction that's almost just as bad. And like people were taking this book and using it to like spin other bullshit about Sparta. So one of the things I've been trying really hard to do since the book came out is get back to center and kind of be like, look, I want to expose the bronze lie, but I don't want to cover it up with another lie.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. So the answer is no, Sparta was not a democracy, but the democracy that's held up, which is Athens, was also not really a democracy, mm-hmm. not by the standards that we consider, which is a real representative government where all of the citizens of the polis, which is the city state, would have had the political franchise. But no, Sparta was an oligarchy. It was ruled by a tiny elite that had a slave caste called the Helots. That did almost all of the agricultural and house labor. It was an apartheid sort of state. It looked a lot more like medieval Europe with a ruled by barons, I think is probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, the breakdown of the Helots was a very interesting thing to me, because you know slaves were clearly not unique to Sparta, but there was this interesting concept of the Helots versus the peers, as they're called, the population you describe in your book that is the sort of the aristocratic population that has the ability to learn how to fight. And it sounds like there's really a very tiny minority that had the power. I don't know what that's like. That's weird. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But I do think it's really interesting. And you mentioned it already. You mentioned that the word Spartan now, for us, it means someone who has like an indifference to comfort or luxury and spurns wealth. Was that part of it true? The wealth aspect of it, the Spartan, quote unquote, lifestyle, was that an accurate depiction?
So I would say no. But look, again, this is really important. So, and this is the thing about history. So there's a very important historian in my life, Dr. Michael Livingston. He's a medievalist. We starred together on a TV show called Contact, and we've co-authored a book called The Killing Ground, which is a book about the Thermopylae, which is where 300 was fought. But there's something we're tracking, something like 18 battles that were fought there from 480 BC or before 480 BC all the way to World War II. No one's written a book about all of them, and that's coming out in February. But Mike, look, I'm an autodidact, right? I'm a self-taught historian. My background's in the military. I taught myself Latin and Greek. I've done the work to do this scholarship. Mike's a 30-year professional scholar, right, and a professor. So we work really closely together. And one of the things he has always said to me, which I take to heart, is that if you're really going to be an historian, the important thing is it has to be getting it right, not being right. So one thing historians hate to say is, I don't know. We hate it because if we don't know, what the hell do you need us for, right? Sure. But the truth is, when you talk about ancient Sparta, where most of the sources are lost, and they have this in common with the ancient Celts, is that they don't write about themselves. We have no writing from Spartans. We have some epigraphy, which is to say inscriptions, but very, very few. So when we talk about who we thought the Spartans were, we're getting it from fanboys. We're getting it from Athenians. We're getting it from Corinthians. We're getting it from Romans. And oftentimes we're getting it from people who are 200 to 500 years after the thing they're writing about, which of course means that they could have messed something up. So as we talk about these things, I want to be clear. We're guessing, right? We're making educated guesses, but we're guessing. And a lot of historians don't like to say that. And you'll get a lot of people coming out and speaking with a lot of certainty that they cannot possibly have. And that's one thing I really want to avoid. So back to your question, luxury. No, for example, they didn't use money. They absolutely did use money. And I prove that in a couple of spots in the book. And in fact, that all of their wealth was distributed equally. Well, I show that wealth inequality, wealth accruing through inheritance and through purchasing, created a situation where they couldn't pay their mess dues. You had to pay a fee to be part of the communal mess. And that was what enfranchised you to be a peer, that position you just described. Well, and that wealth inequality caused that body of peers to diminish to the point where they're having to equip and arm their slaves at risk of revolt so they could put enough fighters in the field.
That was a really interesting aspect, like reading about that, about how the system that they set up inherently caused wealth to be concentrated over generations into a smaller and smaller select few, which prevented more of the, you know, the young men from entering the going through the, you know, the gauntlet of the process.
So they call it a goge is the word that most people know, but that's actually a later Latin word. Xenophon calls it the paideia, which means the education. That's the better education. Word.
Gotcha. Yeah. So like going through that process and becoming a peer, less and less people basically could afford to do this and to pay their dues, which included barley, it included crops, it included coins, it included wine, you know, whatever, like the olive oil, all of that stuff. So along with the mythology of Sparta, what I loved about this book is there are things that the modern right wing absolutely would idealize if they knew about it, right? So like the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer individuals to create power and this luxury class is like this like right wing dream, right? That's like a thing, but they don't know what the truth is to even know to idealize that.
some of them do, but yes.
That's true.
The most extreme ones who are perpetuating the myth. But here, I'll do you one better, Will. One of the reasons that wealth continued to perpetuate was that Spartans treated women better than most ancient Greeks. So it's funny, you have this incredibly unequal society. Look, Greece made Saudi Arabia look like a picnic in terms of how women are treated. Like women were... you would be way better off a woman living almost anywhere else than ancient Greece in the ancient world. But Sparta allowed women to inherit. And that was groundbreaking. And in fact, Aristotle just goes nuts like at how awful he thinks this is.
Yeah, but I didn't realize he was so misogynistic.
Oh, he was terrible.
I read that.
He called the Spartan women, thigh flashers because they would exercise in the nude alongside their male counterparts. And I'm not even talking anything sexy, like throwing the discus and wrestling.
Yeah.
It was just too much for that poor guy.
Aristotle, world's clutching first incel.
Yeah.
Okay, listen, we got to get back to 300. Sorry, I'm going to keep bringing this back to 300.
Okay, go for it.
Sorry. What about the popular depiction of that battle, the Battle of Thermopylae? What about that seems accurate? What isn't? The number itself, the 300 that we keep hearing about, what of it was accurate?
None of it. Zero. Take the whole thing and throw it in the trash. It's you know, the words might be accurate that it's called Thermopylae. And in fact, here, the Bronze Lie. So the Thermopylae is one of the focus battles that I dive deep on in the Bronze Lie. And I am about 80 to 90% happy with that depiction. But I do revise it in The Killing Ground, this new book with Michael Livingston that will be coming out in February. And I'll send both of you copies. But we spent a really long time on the ground. I've been to the battlefield now four times, just combing over and taking drone shots. I'm really, really digging into how it was fought. And we think we now have the most comprehensive narrative of exactly what happened there. And I am not exaggerating when I say there is almost nothing in that film that is accurate to it. It was not 300 Spartans. The battle did not go down the way it did. It wasn't even fought in the same configuration and in the same location that it's depicted in the battle in the film. Like every story tick that film goes through, and every visual reference, and it just makes me so angry too, because the actual visuals. And I tweeted this too again back when I used Twitter. I showed one of those crappy gray helmets that they're wearing. And then I showed a reproduction of an actual Spartan king's helmet, what Leonidas's helmet might have actually looked like. And it's like holding up a Da Vinci next to some kid scratching on the back of some lined paper. And so they literally neutered the real badassery and visual impressiveness of the actual fighting.
So yeah, you won the so again, for our listeners who don't know, and God bless you if this is all new to you, and this is, you know, if you haven't heard any of this, that's fantastic, I guess, but it is a real thing. It's a phenomenon that's been around for a long time. The basic premise is there's this huge Persian army, and this group of white men stands against it. This Westerner stand against it to fight the small group, and they lose.
A very sexy army. Like, I watched 300 and I was like, man, I would be a traitor in a heartbeat. Like, I mean,
the Persians are sexy, so rad.
I mean, exactly.
Everybody, it's a battle of good looking people.
Yes, exactly.
It's true. But there is this huge. A huge aspect of it is that the plan was to basically slow them down, create a chokehold in a small area that the Persian army would have to get through, where their vast numbers would be neutralized, basically.
That idea of slowing and starving the Persian army is the idea I posit in the Bronze Eye. That is not the idea put forward in the film. The idea put forward in the film is that the oracle at Delphi says that if a Spartan king doesn't die, then all of Greece will fall. And so Leonidas is sent as a suicidal sacrifice. And that is hot buttered bullshit. That is not what happened at all. Like, there is just, it's just not true. Now, I can say that Frank Miller and Zack Snyder can be forgiven in that they're cleaving to Herodotus in this, because Herodotus does say this in his narrative. But it doesn't take a lot of work. It doesn't take a lot of cross-referencing other sources to be like, no, that's not what happened.
Yeah, this wasn't a suicide mission like is so romantically, portrayed so often.
No, it was two very skilled generals with very good plans, and the Persians outgeneraled the Greeks. They were a little bit smarter, and no one wants to admit that because it's not as dramatic as a fated last stand.
Oh man, okay, there's so much I want to address there. One, first of all, let me real quick get back to something you said that I really appreciate, which as a doctor, I really appreciate this, where you're like, well, when there's things that are not clear, historians want to say they know, but sometimes you just can't. Sometimes you have to admit that there's some uncertainty, and the same thing exists in medicine. Like when a new thing comes on that we don't know a lot about, say, for example, COVID, if someone comes out and tells you they know exactly what you should be doing or not doing, that's something to take with a little grain of salt, because it's just so hard to know in those situations, you know? That's something I really like about the outlook you have in this book, and you make very clear that you're doing the best with what you can. And some of these historical sources like Herodotus and Plutarch and these other historians, they would say other weird outlandish shit that we all know is not true. Like, for example, and I know that Xerxes actually used this point, that the Persians actually came, the legend of Perseus, from his son Perses. And the story is that the legend Perseus, the guy with the Clash of the Titans and the Medusa's head, like his son formed the Persians. That's the Greek version of where the Persians come from,
right?
Which is like ridiculous, obviously, which is not how it works, which is kind of fun for me to think about, because Perseus was kind of a fun character to read about, but it's not true. Mm-hmm. Xerxes actually, I heard, knew that, and he used that as a selling point when he went to like Greece, and he was like, come on, we're all like one family here or something.
Yeah, well, just think about how brilliant that is. And yeah. and also prior to that, we have Persian generals sacrificing at the Temple of Apollo. And look, these are all examples. One of the things that pisses me off so much about 300 is that the Persians are depicted as total morons, just throwing frontal assaults at this impregnable position and being cut to pieces. Like, they're just total idiots. Yeah. And these examples you just gave, the skillful marshaling of Greek mythology, of Xerxes and Darius before him, looking at the Greeks and going, these are really, really religious and spiritual people. They have a custom of xenia, of guest friendship. If we can show that we have real ties to them, cultural and spiritual ties to them, that's going to make the countryside a lot less hostile. Let's get this message moving. That is brilliant, dude. Yeah. That is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And speaks volumes about what a great general Xerxes was.
What you're doing that I appreciate, and what you did in this book, you know, as I've gotten older, I've learned a lot more and more about Persians and our contribution to the world. Like, you know, everything from like neurosurgery to pajamas to high heels
to this podcast.
Pretty sure I invented podcasting. I'm not sure if that's been widely dispersed, but I'm the first podcaster. But you're the first historian I've seen that posits this very basic concept, which is, what if this giant empire that was able to somehow conquer and rule huge swaths of the world weren't complete fucking idiots? What if they were like, maybe not fucking brilliant, but like not shitheads? Like, the first time I've seen that, which is like really fucked up and kind of sad when I think about it now and I say it out loud, but really the first time I've seen it where it's posited like, well, let's assume that the Persians had an idea of what they were doing.
Well, that's Mike's law of incompetence, right? As I incompetently recite what you wrote, the law of competence, which says that, like, don't ascribe stupidity to these generals that were very successful back in their day just because the narrative, says that, oh, they tripped and fell and, fell on a rake and it hit him in the head or some shit. No, it's like there's it. I appreciated that part of what you're talking about, Mike. Like, explain the law of competence, basically.
It's just the idea that if you are in a position of command, so you remember, you don't get to be the king of kings and stay on the throne. The moment you ascend to the throne, indeed, Xerxes dealt with a major revolt as soon as he ascended. Everyone in the world is gunning for you.
Right.
So like, if you're able to remain in that position, you're doing it by and large because you're good, not because you're bad. Now, if you are, there certainly are incompetent generals and idiot kings, and we certainly see that throughout history, but you're going to know when those people are in those positions. And of course, competent people make mistakes. But by and large, you're way better off assuming that people are making decisions out of good reason and not out of stupidity, lacking additional data. And that position has served me pretty well. And let me give you an example, Kaveh, from 300. Is this idea that there's a secret goat track, right? And Ephialtes has to expose it. Ephialtes is the
Looking up, I'm on IMDb trying to remember that character's name because I was going to bring up this example. So I'm glad.
So Ephialtes, Willie, in modern Greek, the word means nightmare. That's how his name endured through history. But so the idea that he had to show the Persians the secret goat track around the Spartan rear, never mind the fact that there was not one trail that flanked the position. There was like eight of them. But look, you're going to tell me that the biggest empire in the known world with the most sophisticated intelligence network that has done all of this battle prep before even getting here, laying in stores, digging a canal, they're not going to do scouting? They're not going to hire local people and be like, what are the paths around here? Yeah, they're just going to not know, right? That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it relies on the idea that they have just through dumb luck, just through the ableism present in the Spartan society, it becomes like their fortune is that's what favors
them.
It's bad luck.
That's the only reason the Spartans.
If the Spartans were just nicer to disabled people, this would have
exactly.
Never...
That's essentially what it posits. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of competency, if you don't stay tuned and listen to all these commercials, then I will question yours. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, we're back. You know, there's a lot more about this this movie. I remember when it came out, 300. I remember having pretty intense disagreements online with friends on Facebook. One particular friend who, you know, I love the guy from high school. I've known him for a long time. And I remember being like, this movie is, this is not a good movie to have right now. I think it's an unhealthy thing to expose our nation to in a time where there's already this weird sort of hostility against the Middle East, and it's not historically accurate. And I remember getting to the big argument, and the person was like, no, listen, it's just an allegory. It's just like any other movie. You know, it's like, you know, Lord of the Rings was an allegory of World War II. And I'm like, well, I mean, that might be true, but there's a difference between calling them orcs and calling them Persians, because the Persians were real. Right. And I remember like being pretty upset about it, but being really in a very small minority of people. Now, Will, you were a young lad at the time. Mike, you too. Be honest with me. Don't lie to me, guys. Don't lie. Don't put on any bullshit right now. I want to know, when you watch the movie as young men, able-bodied, hot-blooded American males, you watch that movie and come out being like, fuck yeah, gonna fucking fuck up some fucking Middle Easterners. Like, tell me, what were your thoughts?
Mike, I'll go first. I enjoyed it just on the most surface level way possible. Honestly, I wasn't that familiar with the story. I'd vaguely, you know, I knew the word Spartan. I knew of Sparta, but I did not know much of anything. And I remember watching it. You know, my dad worked in the film business growing up. Like, I'm not under any preconceived notion that this is like historical accuracy. But at the same time, I thought maybe there were more, like, I didn't know. Did the Persians have like some kind of explosives that you know, in the movie they're hurling like gunpowder, like, you know, like
it's naphtha. Bombs it's and naphtha. Shit. Yeah, it's naphtha, and there is some evidence that they had it, but it wouldn't have looked or worked like what it looked like.
Right. So like, so I thought maybe, you know, obviously this is the most Hollywooded, roided up movie imagine version of this, but Hannibal had his elephants. Were there rhinoceros? You know, like, was he marching with rhinos? Like, what the fuck, man? Like, I was enthralled by it. And obviously, like, it was the beginning of Frank Snyder's, like
Zack Snyder.
Or Zack Snyder, yeah. Zack Snyder's, style. And it was so unlike anything else that had been put out that I was enthralled with it on that level for the most part. No, I did not want to go fuck up some Middle Easterners personally. That was not my bag. Never was really my bag. I born and raised in the South. I kind of like, you know, the harder everybody around me pushed in one direction, I'm like, I don't want anything to do with this. That's where I was coming from.
Mike, well, you did a lot of military service. I mean, was this, I feel like probably military service, like, used this in some way, whether they purposely did or not, like, it probably increased like some military service. How did it affect you?
Yeah, like all people who didn't know anything about Islam, I viewed Islam post 9/11 as an existential threat to all democracy and to all of Western civilization. And I went to Iraq and I fought. And I was lucky, I guess, to be an intelligence officer. And in because I was doing intel work, I had to learn Islam and I had to read the Hadith and Sunnah and I had to understand the Quran and I had to really, really, you know, in fact, one of the big things I worked was, one of the things I'm most proud of was predicting bombings on Shia pilgrimage routes that Al-Qaeda in Iraq were doing. But when you really come to understand Islam, you fall in love with it. And you understand that that the gulf between the public impression of what Islam is, certainly there are Islamic extremists, certainly there jihad is a horrible thing. Certainly, I'm not discounting any of that. We have a problem, right? Yeah. And we're seeing it right now.
Yeah.
But the idea that is Islam writ large is just, you can't come to that conclusion unless you know nothing about it. And I wish, one of the great regrets in my life is that I had to participate in that fucking war in order to learn that. And I'm, you know, I do what I can now to, you know, I mean, I don't know, you can't make up for participating in a war. You just have to live with it. But yeah, man, that movie, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, it wasn't until 2017 that I taught myself Latin and Greek and really got myself into ancient warfare and really became a serious scholar of it. And that was when I really was able to gain access to this story and just see what a travesty it was.
You know, there's a lot to be said there. One thing I have to say, I really appreciate it. I also really appreciate the fact that, I exist in a very leftist sort of world. I mean, where I live and the people I interact with. And I think there is a real misconception amongst, and I hope it's changing, maybe it is, amongst the people I exist upon of military personnel. And assuming all military personnel are one sort of like monolithic type of dude. And that's just, it's not the case. They're humans and they're people just like us, and they have varying political opinions just like us. And they see and they learn and do different things just like us. And I think it's really important for someone to have your experience and have done that and still come out and write about it. And I really appreciate that. So I want to put that out there right now. And make sure I can give voice to that too, you know? Like, I don't know how much truth there was to the whole story. You would hear stories about like people coming back from Vietnam being spit upon for being baby killers or whatever. I don't know if that was even true, if that happened or not, but I'm sure there was some ill will towards soldiers. So many of them are people who go over not necessarily knowing why they're there or just trying to do their best in bad situations.
Just to touch on that, my dad was, he was over there, 68, 69. And, he failed his senior year of high school on purpose, because he got his draft card and he wanted to avoid it as long as possible. And he grew up in a very small town in North Carolina. You know, he'll tell you this. He grew up, they called themselves lint heads, or that's at least they, you know, the rich kids called them lint heads because he grew up in a mill village, you know, little company homes. And he didn't know what Vietnam was. He didn't know where that was on a map. He couldn't have told you anything about that. He got his draft card and his mom was crying when he came home from school because she got it in the mail and knew what it was. And my grandfather was in World War II. There's a longer story where both of them didn't get their respective medals till 40 years after their service. But that's it's a story for another time. But point being is that he was terrified, had no idea what the conflict was about. You know, poor, you know, country dude from North Carolina, didn't, he was scared, you know, and all he knew was like, it was either this or go to jail. And his dad was in World War II. So he thought, you know, he had to go too. And that was all there was to it. So, you know, and he talked about when he came back over here, the names he got called and stuff, and he felt horrible. But as with a lot of guys of that generation, you just start drinking and that's how you cope. So that's the recipe.
There was plenty of that on my end too, but the one thing I will say is, by and large, I have not been mistreated. You know, by and large, I've been mostly honored. There's been a few situations where people have not. Especially what's so interesting is, look, I'm just honest about it, right? And it's funny, like you're honest about what you did and how you feel about it. And I don't feel great about it. And you sort of, I think you subconsciously expect people to be like, oh, you know, thanks for being vulnerable and honest. And everyone, I've had occasions where people are like, no, dude, you're a fucking murderer, you know? And I've just had to be like, well, I guess I got to wear that.
Just roll with
but
it,
I can't compare my reception coming back home to what your father went through. So he absolutely has.
The military quite often, goes after young men that know the least about what the conflicts are. And it's, I've heard it called a poverty lottery before, where, you need money for school, you need money for housing and stuff. And it offers that. So it's, it's part of the recipe. So,
I mean, they're smart. I mean, there's a reason you got put into intelligence. I mean, they knew that they were going to get the most out of you there. You know what I mean? They're smart. They know how to use people there, and that was the right place for you, obviously.
Yeah, they nailed the shit out of that. By the way, they did a really good job.
Good job with that. So, getting back to the Spartans, I'm not a huge fan, at least of the public perception of them, because of how it's been misused, and we're gonna get more into that at the end here. I want to talk more about that, but you know who was into the Spartans besides Steve Bannon, who's apparently like really into the Spartans? And
is he really?
Yeah. What's the deal?
It's his password. It was his password on his computer.
Oh my god, I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, he looks like raw biscuit dough. He's the last
people.
Spartans.
This is amazing. Is these guys, they admire the Spartans so much. I'm like, these people would have walked you like a dog.
Exactly. You know?
Well, okay, so that
would have been that guy would have been a fucking footrest.
Yeah.
So one of the Spartan myths is of this, like, they only pick the finest and the best. And you know who else was a big fan of that was Hitler was a big fan of the Spartans and the eugenics that was associated with them. Now, he touted that their eugenics sort of program that we're sort of like taught to believe, like they would throw out like the babies that didn't seem like strong, but is that true? Okay.
No, it is not true. And
so they're
again,
normal
like,
humans. They're not monsters either.
Like, there's so many examples. Like, and the thing that's so funny is the person who perpetuates that myth is Plutarch. Plutarch is a Roman citizen, Greek language writer, who his sayings of the Spartan women's and his life of Lycurgus are really like the main sources that we have for all of this bullshit. And he himself gives anecdotes of Spartan women like talking to their crippled sons or like helping their crippled sons to battle. And it's like, wait a minute. Well, and I go into the Greek. Like, if you look at the Greek, the dude didn't get crippled. He was born crippled. And you can tell by the words that are used. So it's like, wait a minute. I thought we were supposed to throw that guy off a cliff. And never mind the fact that one of the most famous Spartan kings, who is one of their greatest generals, is noted for having a club foot.
I guess
they missed the memo there. And like, there's tons of stuff. And there's another example. So one of the other things that is part of the Bronze Lies, this idea that if a Spartan ever loses or runs from battle, he has to commit suicide or he'll be ostracized. 120 Spartan peers, right? These homoioi who are expected to be always brave and never, they all surrender at the end of the Battle of Sphacteria in, I believe, 425 BC. And the Spartan state goes to no end to ransom them back. They don't say, oh, these weaklings, they're no true Spartans, let them rot in Athenian prison. Nope, they get them back. And when they get them back, the king intervenes so that they won't be punished. Mm. They are normal human beings, and normal human beings love their kids.
Seriously. Yeah.
But it's just that, like, no.
That's something I really like about the book, too. I'm going to keep plugging the shit out of this book. One thing
it's
is...
It's so good.
You're not trying to make them seem like shitty people. You're trying to make them seem like people. You're trying to make them seem like normal humans, which is what it's all about. Like, and to hold them up to a standard that is not really accurate or not, it is not fair to them even. But you know, there's a couple aspects of the book you didn't go into great detail about this, and I'm, because it's a different topic, it's not, I feel like there's multiple tomes been written about this, but I don't understand this relationship of the younger soldier and the older man mentoring them in a sort of sexual but not necessarily sexual relationship. Can you explain that? And is that real? I mean, that's kind of what we joke about a lot when it comes to the Spartans, but is that what was the truth behind that? And was that unique to them amongst other Greeks?
Right. So first of all, no, it was not unique to them amongst other Greeks at all. Second of all, I want to be clear. Again, we have to be clear. We don't know, right? With the, you know, we are doing our best with the very limited information we have. And the third thing is, I want to caveat my own lack of expertise here, right? I'm not a social historian. I'm a military historian. So I certainly looked at this phenomenon of the Eromenos and the Erastes, which is the listener and the hearer, insofar as it pertained to military training. But whole books have been written about these relationships from a social perspective, which is really where it comes to. And near as I can tell, the sexual component was part of it, but it was a lesser part of it. It was more of a social enfranchisement mentorship deal where you're a promising young man and someone sponsors you and they bring you up and they teach you to fight and they give you things. But most importantly is they make introductions. Like if you think about debutante balls in the South, which still go on to this day, you know, there's a lot that goes into them. But one of the important things is when you're coming out in those balls and when you're a friend or a relative or whatnot, the big, you know, business magnates of that town, the people who are going to employ you and do favors for you, they're seeing you, they're meeting you, they're being impressed by you. And it seems like
a Rotary Club. It's Kiwanis.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly but the sexual thing is what we all get hung up on. And look, I'm sorry. Homosexuality, it certainly come in for a heck of a bashing. But it was a lot more casual and a lot more accepted in earlier societies and Mediterranean societies and is still to this day in different places. And it seems like there was more, certainly not total, like this idea that everyone is sleeping with boys. You know, Xenophon himself calls it an abomination and says that people don't do it. So clearly there are some sectors of society, even in ancient Greece, that frowned upon it. So they just had a different attitude about that than we do to this day. But the important thing when we look at that relationship is, while sex certainly was involved and romance certainly was involved, that wasn't the core of it. The core of it seems to have been, I, as an older person, am going to help this young aristocrat get his start in society.
Yeah, it's really interesting. That's a very interesting sort of like dynamic there. I don't know about often, like the Southern balls, but I'm curious to know, Will, did you experience this?
No, I was never a debutante, thank God. I would argue that type of dynamic is very much well and alive in Hollywood, in the entertainment industry, in that type of thing. I had a Kaveh, if you don't mind, I had kind of a couple quick questions. So I had the thought, I was talking with my coworker who I'm going to lend this book to next to read. He's super excited about it. I wanted to know, you know, similar to like American history, we learn the names of the wars that America was involved with. And then you find out that in countries over in Europe and stuff, they call it something completely different. And obviously their narrative about things is going to be from their perspective, just like ours is from our perspective. And then I was curious if Persian history had their account of events of the battle at Thermopylae and like what that sounded
great
like.
Great question. I had the same question.
Yeah. So this is something that we talked about before we started recording, Will. First of all, there are better historians to answer this question. Tom Hyland and his Persian Interventions is probably the best person to speak to it. The real answer for me is I don't know. And one of the disadvantages I'm at, and I talked to Kaveh about this, is that the lack of relations between the United States and Iran means that it's almost impossible for me to get access to modern Persian scholars who are surely working on this thing. So I really don't want to answer that question and give you a bullshit answer. But one of the great crimes is, look, one of my dreams is to be able to safely go to Persepolis and Susa and read the inscriptions and meet with Persian scholars, with translators, so I could try to get answers to these. But there are English language scholars working in this field. And the best one I can think off the top of my head is Tom Hyland, Hyland, and his book Persian Interventions, I think, is probably the best read on this. So, but I don't want to give you a bullshit answer.
No worries. Well, so my coworker Aaron, he said that he has read and heard before that one of the reasons why we remain so enthralled with Greek and Roman military history is because when the historians were writing accounts of it, they wrapped it in a compelling narrative. You know, they kind of gave it a treatment, you know, almost like a script treatment before putting it down in history. And it kind of made me, I don't know if that's 100% accurate or if it like made it, you know, the way like oral tradition, you know, you tell stories, you hit the beats, you kind of have like narrative arcs and stuff. It made me think about the fact that we are living with this version of the Spartans that has been done by Hollywood through this narrative, this hyper narrative. It's like we made a modern version with Frank Miller's 300 and Zack Snyder's 300 and the culture and pop culture around it that the Greeks and the Romans were doing way back when. We just did a modern Hollywood treatment of it.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And I love it. What a great way to put it. I can give you a couple of examples here. But the first thing I want to say is that we as modern people, when we consider history, we are used to this idea of objectivity, this idea that historians are investigators, that we vet sources, we consider evidence, we compare accounts to each other. You know, we carbon date things. We is this eyewitness reliable? Is that eyewitness reliable?
You're a detective. You're a detective.
Yeah, I've been I've been both a police investigator and an intelligence officer. And what I always tell people is that police investigator, intelligence officer, and historian, they're almost the same thing. In that they're really trying to get at the truth through considering evidence. But that idea of objectivity and investigation is modern. It's not ancient.
Right,
and in fact, Herodotus is famous for being one of the first people to say, I'm just going to try to figure out the truth here instead of trying to tell a story. Hmm. And the best example for what you're talking about is that Plutarch, and again, Plutarch, this writer who's 500 years after the fact, a Greek-speaking Roman, he is our main source for most of this bullshit about Sparta. And he is not writing a history. He is writing a morality book. It's
right.
It's comparing famous Greeks and famous Romans' lives with the goal, A, obviously, of showing how great Romans are, because that's where he lives, right?
Sure.
And B, improving the reader's moral character. He's not trying to tell you the truth. And he's not even making that claim. And that is the basis by which we know Sparta all the way through till today. So you are exactly right in your interpretation of that.
You know, it's such a interesting topic that you cover. And, you know, I'm not even a guy who's into military stuff or military history. I am as pacifist as they come.
Me either, by the way. Like, this is the first book I've ever read on this topic, and I'm fascinated by it.
It is. You review like 126 different military entanglements or battles or incursions, whatever the word is. Of these, only 50 seem to have been won by the Spartans.
Right.
And it's really fascinating that they were able to build this Spartan mirage from that, and it's almost like a testament to the branding that they were able to do at the time, because as we've discussed, I mean, like we took it to the next level with like these movies, 300 in the comic, etc. But even before then, it was there enough to inspire Frank Miller and the guy who made the movie that inspired Frank Miller. So like, how did they have like a machine in order to do that? Like, were they the first masters of PR?
Right. So the answer is, I don't know, but I think they didn't. I don't think they did it. I think other people did it for them. Right. I think the Athenians did it mostly. There's a great example, and I don't know if I use it in the book. I think I do. If not, I certainly use it in my article in the New Republic. So Tom Holland, who is one of my favorite historians.
Great actor. One of the second best Spider-Man.
No.
Second best Spider-Man.
Everybody says this. They go, so Tom Holland gave us a cover quote for the Killing Ground, our book coming out in February. Everyone's like, oh, Spider-Man loved your book. And I'm like, it's not that.
You know what? Like, okay, just similar just to like the Taylor. Similar to the NFL and Taylor Swift. Just like use that.
Use
just
it.
Roll with it.
Let
yeah.
it go.
Use it.
Yeah. yeah.
All right, so Spider-Man, he's one of the best historians out there, and I really, really love his work. He wrote an article, I can't remember when he wrote it, but it's a review of the film 300. And one of the things he talks about is that the Battle of Thermopylae, which is portrayed in the film 300 as this glorious defeat, I guess, it was such a futile fart and high wind. Like, it was such The Greeks got steamrolled. They just got their asses handed to them. And Themistocles, who's sort of the head of the Greek coalition, is like, holy shit, we just got beat so bad that all of Greece is going to surrender. If I'm going to have any hope of holding this coalition together, we need a propaganda victory right now. Hell and yeah. He spins this bullshit story about a fated suicide mission that, and it gets legs, man. Like, it takes off. And Tom Holland posits this in his review of the film 300 a few years ago. And I think he's really onto something there, because Themistocles was absolutely a master spin doctor. The Greeks just got steamrolled. And that is, it was the only way that could have saved the day. And in fact, it did.
You think I look bad, you should see the other guy. Like, that's, yeah, that's, he was like the originator of that shit, you know? Like, yeah, I know I look like I got my ass kicked, but I put that dude in the hospital.
Well,
you know?
So we say in The Killing Ground, when Leonidas executes his brilliant plan at Thermopylae and just gets fucking killed, we go, he meant to do that. That's what the origin story. That's what the origin. Oh, he was committing
masterful
suicide.
Play.
He meant to do that.
Masterful play.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, right. Well played. Yeah.
Excellent gambit, sir.
So, okay, this is, I guess, should be our last topic here. Although I could talk to you for hours, man. But you, me in too. Your book, you cover so many different aspects of the Spartan mirage. You know, the cult of personality, the discipline, the strength, the Spartan quote unquote ethic, the shunning of riches, their piousness, whether or not that was true or not, of all these things that you cover and you sort of break down very like tactfully during the process of this book. Let me ask you, what's the danger with a little hero worship? What's the problem with the Spartan fad exercises that popped up after that movie? What's the problem with these people trying to make a little money off of the Spartan mythology mythos? Tell me what's the issue here?
So there's three issues. I did an article on this for Smithsonian Magazine. In the end of it, I really lay it out. The first issue is that I'm actually horrified by political extremism on both the right and the left, though I consider myself a leftist. But I am not talking about regular conservative people with whom we can disagree reasonably. I am talking about the most extreme, you know, elements on the right uniformly use the Spartans as icons. And that is not cool and not okay. And, you know, so for example, I'm a Buddhist. The swastika is a core image among Buddhists. We can't use it. It's destroyed by the Nazis. Yeah. So it's the same thing here, is that no. You don't get to own history. I'm sorry. You know, and if just by telling the truth, I can put a pin in that balloon, I'm happy to do that. The second thing too is that the truth matters. The truth matters, right or wrong, you know, good or bad. We like it, we don't like it. The truth matters. And we are either people, like, I'm not an alternative facts person, right? Like, I want to know, you know, look, obviously there's nuance and people can disagree about things, but when it comes down to facts, they matter. And that record I want set straight for all the ripples it sends out into the universe. But the third thing, and this is the thing that really, really upsets me, is that the Spartans were truly extraordinary people. And our ability to connect to and be inspired by and learn from other people really depends on our ability to see ourselves reflected in them and to sort of think, wow, you know, if they could do that, maybe I could too. And when you replace human beings with bronze statues, you know, it's funny. That's why I hate Frodo Baggins, right? When people talk about, this is from The Lord of the Rings, people talk about Frodo Baggins, I hate him.
You know, I've heard of that. I've studied that battle before. That
was horrible. What is Frodo Baggins' worst character flaw? He's excessively earnest. Like, I don't think that guy's ever taken a shit in his life. Like, he's just like, there's nothing wrong with him. Like, he smiled too sheepishly. Like,
yeah,
no,
he doesn't
dude,
have
I
flaws.
Can't.
Yeah, he's
I
not
can't
great.
Identify. I can't identify with a character like that. Right. You know, and we rob people of our ability to truly connect with who the Spartans were when we talk shit about them and weave these bullshit stories, and we do it, you know, based on our own insecurities. We feel inadequate and we want an example to live up to, you know, well, we're going to be as tough as the Spartans, but you're not. You're going to be as tough as a lie that you made up, because the actual Spartans were humans like you, and coming to grips with your own humanity is the way. not holding yourself up to some impossible standard. That's what bothers me about it.
Yeah.
To touch on your first point about like taking symbols and imagery and kind of ruining it, as a fat guy with a lot of Hawaiian shirts in the closet that
he's
I'm sitting
holding
in,
up one now,
I refuse to let the Boogaloo Boys like take this from me. Like, I know that I'm bald. I know I have a big beard. I know I have tattoos. I know I'm fat. I know I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt, but God damn it, I'm not an accelerationist, and I don't want to murder you with a, you know, wearing a goddamn ceramic plate on my chest. So,
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
As somebody who has fought in Iraq,
yeah,
do you think it's a good idea, if your goal is armed conflict, to wear a hot pink or neon orange shirt that make a 200-yard shot?
It depends on if your battleground is a mall from the 80s, then yes. Outside of that, then no. Absolutely fucking not.
Clearly, I don't understand the Boogaloo app.
Yeah, me either.
But I'm glad you are reappropriating Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah man. With... You take it. That's yours. Don't give that up. That You cling to that one. I'll fight for your right to wear that shirt.
Me too.
Thank you.
And you're husky, by the way. I wouldn't say fat. It's amazing. It's a really interesting thing how the symbol, it's become a symbol for these far right groups, like the Golden Dawn in Greece is neo-Nazi or fascist, NRA, etc., white supremacists. They use it, you know, they use like the Spartan insignia in this way. It is an unfortunate thing that happens. And they take good stuff, man. Yeah. And they ruin it for us, and they ruin it for everyone. And then we have to just give it up. That's just how it is. Sometimes it's how it is. Good thing is there's a constant influx of new symbols that we can then take fun with. So that's the beauty of symbols, people. We can make them up as we go along.
We've just reappropriated the Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah. For example, Hawaiian shirts. We strongly stand by the Hawaiian shirt here at the House of Pod. Sure. Well, listen, guys, this was such a blast. I mean, Mike, one day, inshallah, boy, that's going to get me on a list somewhere. We'll both go to Iran and we'll travel to Persepolis and we'll get some dope food and get some history there. Mike, tell people where they can get this book that we really, we really did enjoy. You can tell we enjoyed it because it is not a thin book. It is, I mean, I'm pulling it right now, about 460-something pages. It is a big book.
I promise you I'm not compensating for anything. So the best way to find me is just come to my website, myke, I spell it with a Y, myke-colle.com. I'm on social media, but I really try not to use it because social media is poison. My email address is on that website. You can find all my writing. All of my books are there. You can grab the titles and pull them on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And all of my online writing that's freely available, you can click a link and read any of it. It includes a lot of articles about the Spartan, about the Bronze Lie, including the ones I've done for the New Republic and Smithsonian Magazine. And if you want to tell me that I suck, my email's right there. You can shoot me an email.
Man, I can't. I mean, I hope nobody does that. I'm sure somebody will.
Every damn day, dude. I've gotten death.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. It's a great. I can't wait to read the next one. The Killing Field, you said?
The Killing Ground. Yeah. And again, for both of you, please do not buy it. I will make sure that copies get sent to you.
Oh man. Yeah. Well, I guess you're going to have to come back for that one then. Because we're going to have to talk about that some more. Will, where can people find you? Will.
Me. You can find me on Twitter at The Waffle House, WAPPLEHOUSE. You could listen to us on Jort Center Pod. Jort Center is the podcast I do with some buddies of mine. We actually did a 300 episode because I rewatched it with my son about a year and a half ago. He had never seen it before. And as I'm watching it, I'm going, wait a second. This is the root of all of the alpha male bullshit that I see on Instagram every single day and all of the TikToks and all of this. Like, it just like it all clicked for me. And I was like, all the dudes running for office right now that are like my age were the prime age to absorb this and not think critically about it ever again, just model their entire existence after it. So you can find that episode on George Center and come follow me and listen to me there.
great show. And also Will or Christy Yamaguchi Maine is like one of the few reasons I actually am still involved online. It's just really fun to follow you there. Man, what a blast this was. What a great book. I can't wait to hang out with both you guys again sometime in the near future. Thank you both so much. Everyone, if you haven't already, rate and review us. I get a real, real kick out of reading those reviews when you leave them for me on iTunes. Really appreciate it. Bye.
Thanks.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.